Psalm 1 was presented by Ron Julian on May 17, 1998 at Reformation Fellowship. The copyright for this recording is held by Gutenberg College, Inc., 1998. Gutenberg College is a nonprofit organization, and contributions may be made at www.gutenberg.edu. This material may be copied and distributed in whole for non-commercial and educational purposes, subject to the inclusion of this introduction, all other rights reserved. A brief break occurs in the middle of the following recording. It is the result of the original audio tape switching to the second side.
Okay, well, we're going to look at Psalm 1, which is a favorite of mine. And I would be interested from you, actually, if you have any thoughts on where you might like me to go. Let me reword that. I am going to be here, but given that I'm going to be here, if there's anything you might like to hear me talk about. I have been trying to sort of put together, about a half a year ago, the publisher was telling me that they would like me to write something else, and I've just been putting off deciding what that might be or hoping that it would go away somehow, because writing the last book just about did me in, so I'm not sure that I want to take on another one. But one thought that did cross my mind is if I get to decide on what it was I might want to do, I could essentially do a series here on that and kind of use the time to get ready for this to prepare something for that as well. So if you have any thoughts, I'm interested. Meanwhile, as I say, I'd like to look at Psalm 1. Let me read it to you. Blessed is the man who does not walk in the counsel of the wicked, nor stand in the path of sinners, nor sit in the seat of scoffers. But his delight is in the law of Yahweh, and in his law he meditates day and night. And he will be like a tree planted by streams of water, which yields its fruit in its season, and its leaf does not wither, and in whatever he does, he prospers. The wicked are not so, but they are like chaff which the wind blows away. Therefore, the wicked will not stand in the judgment, nor sinners in the assembly of the righteous. For Yahweh knows the way of the righteous, but the way of the wicked will perish. Okay, so we start out here. This psalm is a beatitude. Jesus in the Beatitudes in the New Testament was not doing something new. You find this sort of thing in the wisdom literature of the Old Testament, the idea being to assert who is the one who is blessed, who is the one who is to be envied. It's a very important concept. We can treat it as just sort of a greeting card kind of sentiment. Gee, wouldn't it be nice to be like this? Or, it's a lot better to be nice than to be mean, or something like that. But that's not what a beatitude is about. A beatitude is taking the fundamental question that everyone really asks themselves: what is it that I really want? What is it that I ought to want to be? If I'm interested in my own welfare, if I'm interested in the question, what is good for me, which I am interested in and everybody is interested in, then a beatitude is answering that question. You ought to want to be like this, because this is the kind of person who is blessed. This is the person who is in the favor of God, and those who are in the favor of God ultimately receive his blessing. The blessings come to that person who is on God's side. So a beatitude is saying, this is the kind of person you ought to want to be, because if you're this sort of person, you are fortunate. You are to be envied. And that's the kind of imagery I think we ought to have. It's like, we all in this world come to have a certain sense of what it would be that would make us happy, what it would be that it would make life successful. And when we look at other people, we say, now, okay, now there's a person. That person has got it. That person has got what I want. And there's this natural sort of draw to it. I look at it and say, yeah, I wish I were like that. Well, a beatitude is coming along and saying, this is what you ought to look at and say, that's what I want to be. Because if I were that, I would be blessed. So that's the theme of the psalm. This is a theme that shows up a lot in the Bible because, contrary to what we sometimes get the picture of, the Bible is about, at least part of the Bible, a significant part of the Bible, is about the question, what is it that is going to make life good? Where am I going to find salvation, fulfillment? I mean, we can make this big list of those needs of the human heart that the Bible is not telling me, forget about those needs, put all of that aside, you're going to live in some sort of passionless, blissed out state where you care about nothing and want nothing. That is not the biblical picture. The biblical picture is, of course you want something. You're made to want something. The question is whether you're wanting the things that will really satisfy and will really give you life, or whether you're chasing after an illusion, something that looks like it will satisfy that, but ultimately won't. The person who is blessed is the person who is in touch with reality, who is seeking after that which truly satisfies, and thus in the end finds that satisfaction. So, in this psalm, who is the person who is blessed? Who is the person who receives the favor of God? Who is the person that we ought to envy? It is the man who does not walk in the counsel of the wicked, nor stand in the path of sinners, nor sit in the seat of scoffers. The one who is blessed is the one who does not listen to fools. And this whole psalm basically is about the question, what are you taking in? What are you listening to? Who are your counselors? Where are the ideas that drive your life coming from? Now, it seems to me that the idea here is one that certainly we should stop and think about carefully. Christians over the ages have debated this in the world but not of the world aspect of being a believer. That is, obviously, in this world, there are people whose ideas are bad, and they are so bad that if I were to listen to them and take them in, they would ruin my life. So what do I do about that? One of the choices that believers have made throughout the history of the church is to withdraw, to essentially pull out of the worldly culture around me and create some sort of a retreat, some place where there are only believers around me. So there's the monastery or the communal life where families come together and pull out of the world around. And then there are those on the other side who have argued, no, God has called us to live in the world, to be salt and light in the world, and to actually stand against the evil that we see in the world, but not by retreating from it, but by living in the midst of it and fighting it. And I'm sure there are all kinds of variations in between that we've come up with. So that debate is one that is long in standing, and I'm not really here to resolve the question. All I want to point out in what he's saying here is it seems to me that there are two sides of this that we really ought to take very carefully. Take very seriously. First of all, we should not take this advice about not walking in the counsel of the wicked and so on as an excuse to not listen to the people around us. And what I mean by that is we are called to be truth seekers. And part of having an attitude of wanting to know what is true is being willing to listen to the people around me and discover that they're thinking about things better than I am. To actually be willing to listen to somebody that I disagree with and say, now why are you thinking that? That seems to me to be a part of what we are called to be as people of integrity. If we care about the truth, that we're going to interact with people whose ideas are different than our own and try to understand where they're coming from. Not because everything is true and everybody's ideas are equally valid. Many people's ideas are terrible and ought to be rejected. But I think you're familiar with that kind of approach. We know people who sort of take this attitude that whatever it is I already think is right, and it is a virtue for me to not listen to anybody else. That's not a virtue. I don't think that's a virtue at all. I need to be willing to be confronted by different ideas and respond to them. I think that's part of being a person who cares about what is true. So I don't think he can be saying to us here, in not walking in the counsel of the wicked. I don't think he can be telling us that I should never talk to anybody whose theological ideas are in the least suspect. Because, frankly, if I take that sort of attitude, I'm going to come to the point where I can't even talk to myself. Because none of us have it together so well that we can safely insulate ourselves from other people's ideas. But that's on the one hand. So let's be wise about how we apply what it is he's saying here. But on the other hand, it seems to me that especially, I don't know, as I look around, certainly this group of people here and most of the people I know, I don't think we are likely to err on the side of not listening to the people that we disagree with, not engaging with the culture around us. This is not an isolationist group of people, as far as I can tell, unless I'm missing something. I think that we are much more likely to err on the side of just basically missing the point of what it is that he's saying here and standing in the counsel of the wicked in ways that we really shouldn't. Because it seems to me what he's talking about is he's picturing our lives as being nourished by outside forces. He's going to go on to talk about the tree planted by the waters here. The idea that I take in the things around me and it has an influence on my life. And what I listen to, what I find plausible and interesting, and what the ideas that I take in and live by have a lot to do with my own heart. What is it that I'm willing to hear? What is it that I want to hear? What is it that I find intriguing and wise and compelling? What is it that's forming our values? What are the voices that we're listening to? You probably have a picture of what life would be like if it were good. Where did you get that picture? Who gave it to you? I'd be willing to bet, if you're anything like me, that a lot of that picture that you have has been given to you by television situation comedies and glossy magazines, and I mean, we could go on and on and on. We have in our culture a whole series of counselors that we are listening to that are foolish. They do not understand what life is really about, and we're soaking it in. What is it that I would have in order to be content? Where did that picture of what I have to have in order to be content come from? Who have I listened to? I have a picture of reality in my mind. Where did I get that picture? And how much of that picture has been informed by people who really don't understand what life is all about? Now, you have to understand who's talking here. I mean, I am a person who, at the worst times in my life, have been willing to look at, read, listen to just about anything. Just about anything. So I'm not pointing the finger at anybody here. I'm talking to myself as much as anyone. But the fact is, I think, that we have too easily let our culture tell us not just what life is all about, but too easily tell us who our counselors ought to be. You know, this is really cool over here. This is really entertaining over here. This is really thought-provoking over here. And we come into it rightly so as Christians. We look at it and they say, well, I'm going to be critical about this. I'm going to be careful, and I know there are ideas in here that I'm going to fight. So we fight, you know, the big, well, clearly the worldview in this particular thing that I'm reading or looking at just doesn't have God, and so I can see that's wrong. You know, but it is kind of an interesting book, and I really like that movie and that kind of stuff. And we don't notice, I think, how, you know, we fought off the big evil ideas in the movie or book, and all kinds of little evil ideas just sort of snuck in while we were fighting off the big ones. We're soaking up a picture of what things are like, I think. I'm not here to recommend anything in particular. You know, get rid of your TV, don't go to movies, you know, don't... I'm not prepared to say that that's the answer. There are things that are worth looking at. Things that have bad ideas in them that are worth looking at, I think. It's not that simple. But there's something that he's saying here that I think we ought to take seriously. Because what does he present as the alternative? He's saying here, look, there are those that he's calling the wicked, the sinners, the scoffers. I don't want to go their way. They're going the wrong way. It is, don't go with them. Don't listen to them. In the sense of when you've finally figured out what they're saying and recognize that it's folly, walk away and go where? Well, the blessed one is the one whose delight is in the law of the Lord, and in his law he meditates day and night. If I'm like this tree that is either drinking in the waters or not, what ought I to be taking in? What ought to be influencing the ideas that I have and the picture that I have about what life is about? Well, he says it's the law of God. By which I think we should not define that narrowly as the Mosaic law in terms of, you know, making sure you know which food you're supposed to eat and that sort of thing. But we're talking about the law of God as the revelation of God, what God has shown us in the scriptures about what life is all about. That includes the Mosaic law. As we come into the New Testament, it includes all that we learn about Jesus, all that his apostles taught. It's what God is telling us about the way things are, what he's telling us about himself, what he's telling us about ourselves, what he's telling us about the good life and what it is, what he's telling us about the future, about judgment, about salvation. That's the law of God, I think, as he's talking about it. So you can see that the alternatives that he's presenting here is what is it that I'm going to soak in? What is it that is going to influence the way I think about things? The world around me has an influence, and it's an influence that is foolish because it is not grounded in an understanding of who God is and what things are really about. So he's saying, let your counselor be the law of God. Let what God has revealed in his scriptures, let that be the ideas on which you're feeding. Think about it. As he says, meditate on it day and night. Be interested in what it says. Try to understand the ideas in it, and if you don't understand it, think about it. What's that all about? Why is God saying that? Think about it like nourishment that you're taking in, something that you need to thrive. And we'll talk about that here in a minute. Now, when I come to a statement like this, I come to an unresolved conflict in my thinking about things. And I've talked with you all about this conflict before. He's talking here about delighting in the law of God and meditating in it day and night. The conflict that I have is trying to decide how much every individual child of God is called upon to be a student of the Scripture. There are times, and I will just be honest with you here, there are times when I want to get up here and say to you all, you are fools. You ought to be spending your time looking at the Bible. Why aren't you guys, where are you all when we're teaching classes at the study center on this and that? Why aren't you all there? I'm not prepared to get up and say that because I'm not a prophet, and I don't know the answer to the question, how much is each individual called to be a student of the Bible? So I'm not going to get up here and say that because I don't know that it's true. But what I do know is that each of us is called upon to care what the Bible says. Each of us is called upon. I mean, look at what he's saying here. The blessed person is the one who's thinking about the law of God, who recognizes there are some really important, the most important ideas are being talked about. This is the revelation of God. I mean, for as long as I have been a Christian, I have marveled at myself and everyone else, and I include myself in this, that I find it so easy to be blasé about this book. I mean, if instead of me doing a book signing next Saturday, we were to announce that Amazing Grace Bookstore, Jesus is going to be there, and he'll answer any questions that you have about life, hopefully you would all go. I think you would all go. I think there would be 100% attendance at that. But somehow we have really demoted in our minds this book over that scenario. If he were, boy, I would be there. But somehow this is the Bible. But this is a collection of writings by people who encountered the living God, who understood what he was about, and who told us about it. That's what this is. I mean, that's incredible. I mean, if it's true, if it's not true, if it's just another one of the world's religious writings, then okay, you can study it in college if you want to, or you can appreciate it as literature, and I mean, you can do whatever you want with it. But if what it's claiming about itself is true, it is unique, and it has something to give me that not anything else in the world has to give me. Nothing else has the power to give me what this book can give. There's no other book, there's no other person. If I have anything to contribute to you when I'm standing up here talking today, it's only because I got it out of here. And frankly, you could go look. I mean, it's in there. I mean, I, this is where I got it. So, I mean, all of us have in this book the revelation from God. Now, I absolutely recognize, when I think about the people that I know, all of us have lives where we are called to do various things. We have to take care of our families. We have to support ourselves. There's an awful lot to do. And part of that is just the way things are designed. I mean, we live in a world where God, we're living in a cursed world. I mean, we're under the fall. At the fall of man, God cursed the ground. He says, you're going to eat by the sweat of your brow. You have to work in order to eat. And that's just a reality. And that becoming a believer doesn't change that. I still live in a world like that. So I'm really not here to point the finger at any person or set of priorities. I understand very well the pressures. Robbie and I are under all sorts of pressures these days, and I wouldn't defend a single decision we've made on how to make them, on how to face those pressures. We just do the best we can. And part of what that means for me personally is I'm a teacher of the Bible. I don't have time to look at the Bible anymore. I mean, that's, you know, I've been kind of joking these days, but, you know, I used to teach the Bible, but nowadays I'm into something more lucrative. The only problem with that joke is that it isn't lucrative, so that's kind of the worst of both worlds. But I'm just saying that because I'm not, like I say, I'm not pointing the finger at anybody. I recognize the pressures. But at the same time, what he's saying in this psalm is just, it's just common sense truth. The person who's blessed is the one who is not being influenced so much by the world around him as he is being influenced by the revelation of God and His law. You're going to be influenced by something. You just can't separate yourself from all influences. Something is getting at you. You're listening to something. Something is counseling you. And the question is, what is it that's counseling you? So, I don't have the answer. I don't know what to tell you to do. But the basic idea is very clear. What we ought to be about, if you think of your mind, your spirit, your heart, who you are as a person, as this, I mean, use all sorts of metaphors. It's a garden. I mean, it is something that is growing. It is going to go one way or another. And it all depends on what do you let in. You can't keep stuff out. So what are you going to let in? I think that's behind the metaphor that he uses here, this idea of being either nurtured or not by the things that come in. He says, he will be like a tree planted by streams of water, which yields its fruit in its season, and its leaf does not wither, and in whatever he does, he prospers. The wicked are not so, but they are like chaff, which the wind blows away. So his ultimate picture here is, there is the one who is meditating on the law of God. That's like a tree planted by streams of water. The tree needs the water to live and survive and thrive. And so the one who has sunk his roots deeply into the law of God is the one who's like the tree planted by the stream. The wicked, he says, those who do not care about the law of God, but who listen to other counselors, foolish and wicked counselors, they're like the chaff which the wind blows away. That's the stuff, you know, that's the dried up leftover stuff that's no good. You know, it's the picture, the contrast between the tree that is pulling in the water and growing green and thriving, and there's just that stuff that blows away, the leftover stuff that you don't care about. It had nothing to it. Not nurtured in the end. What it took in didn't cause it to thrive and grow. It just died and it's gone. That's the contrast that he's painting here. Now, one of the questions that comes to mind when we look at this, I know when we have talked about these sorts of things before, this is a question that Bob has raised a number of times before, and I think it's a very good one. In a psalm like this in the Old Testament, when he talks about this person prospering in all that he does, how should we picture that? Because there are certainly in the Old Testament places, proverbs, and examples of people who trust in God and physically prosper. I mean, Abraham was a rich man. There are many people who followed God, as you see in the Old Testament, who prospered in their lives. And it's attributed to God. God did this thing. I'm inclined not to be too hasty in assuming, though, that that's what he's talking about in this psalm. And there's a lot involved in that. I think even the pictures of physical prosperity in the Old Testament are intended to be, it's like living parables, living examples of what it means to follow God, that He is trusted good. The story of Israel being in slavery in Egypt, going through the wilderness and ending up in the Promised Land, that's a very concrete, I mean, they were facing physical deprivation and slavery. They underwent physical hardships in the wilderness, and they enter into a land where their physical needs are taken care of, and they conquer the land and have a measure of freedom that they didn't have before. But it becomes clear, even in the Old Testament account, that God's physical dealings with Israel are intended to teach them something about His reliability, but it does not exhaust or even really sum up what it is that God is about or what He wants for us as people. And by the time we get to the New Testament, it becomes clear with, you know, Jesus saying to the crowd, don't work for the bread which perishes. I mean, I could give you all the bread you could eat for the rest of your life and you wouldn't really be any better off because you have a deeper problem than that. So in the first place, I think the Old Testament, when it talks about physical prosperity, is reminding us of the faithfulness of God and that He is the one to go to. He knows what we need and He has the power to provide it. In this particular context, I think we see, ultimately, as the psalm ends here, that he has a deeper issue than in mind. He's not just saying if you meditate on the law a lot, your business will really thrive and you'll have a lot of money. Because notice where it ends up. Therefore, the wicked will not stand in the judgment, nor sinners in the assembly of the righteous. For Yahweh knows the way of the righteous, but the way of the wicked will perish. So this picture of being dried up like chaff and blowing away is not just a picture of these poor wicked people are going to be, their businesses are going to fail, and boy, they're going to be sorry they were so bad because they're going to see all the Christians around them with the prosperous stores and that kind of thing. That's not his picture. He's talking about the ultimate prosperity or the ultimate loss of a person. Yes, God causes his people to prosper. That's what he's all about. But in taking Israel to the promised land, he took them through the wilderness, and he did it on purpose. He is not beyond, not by any means is he beyond, taking us through a period of deprivation in order to teach us and ultimately to bring us into what will be a deeper and more meaningful prosperity, a prosperity of the soul, a prosperity that leads us into real life, into what life is meant to be. So the picture here, we don't want to downplay it. The person who feeds, who finds sustenance in the Word of God, in what God has said in the Bible, will prosper like a tree planted by the waters. That's the truth. That's not just a general sort of statement that has lots of exceptions. There are no exceptions. If my counselors are the wicked and the foolish, I will perish. And if my counselors are those who have written in God's law, then I will prosper. That's the truth. That's just the way it works. But we need to be careful about that picture. I'm not saying to you that things are going to necessarily be wonderful today. This is a theme that we talk about a lot. But part of the reason I bring it up a lot is because the Bible talks about it a lot. And part of the reason I bring it up a lot is because in the Christian world around us, it is very, very easy to find people who were prepared to tell you that the gospel is about prospering today. And there are those who would say to me, Ron, you're teaching another gospel because you are not giving people the hope for their prosperity today. And my answer to them is basically, I know you are, but what am I? Which is to say, I think they're teaching another gospel. I mean, you got to make a choice. One of us is wrong, and I would argue that it's them. But emphasizing that we want to understand the subtleties of this picture of the prosperity that comes to God's people, nonetheless, it is true. That's what God is about. The purpose of all of this is that those who are feeding on the truth as God has revealed it, the result is that they will stand in the assembly of the righteous. When the day of judgment comes, they will stand. They will be among those who are God's people. And whatever the path was that took them there, whether it was smooth or rocky or curvy or whatever, the fact is anyone would look at the assembly of the righteous and say, these are the ones who prospered. These are the ones that you would want to be like. there's one other thing that probably would be worth talking about here in the psalm. He keeps talking about the wicked and the righteous. And I mean, this is a common theme around here, but you probably know what I'm going to say, but I want to emphasize how I understand this at this point. Because, frankly, in my early days as a Christian, I would not have understood what this is talking about, and I wouldn't have known what to do with it. Because the first thing that I got a hold of was this idea that I'm a sinner and that I am saved by the grace of God. Not because of my works, not because I'm so good, but because God is graciously overlooking the fact that I'm not. And that is true, and that is absolutely true, and I haven't changed my mind about that in any way. But what I concluded back then was, well, if that's true, then there cannot possibly be any sense in which there is anything good about me or required to be good about me in order to be a person of faith. And so every statement in the Bible that talks about someone who's righteous or someone who has done what is right or something like that, I would have come along and said, yeah, but I'm saved by grace, which was essentially to say this doesn't apply to me. I mean, yeah, the righteous are those, you know, who are going to prosper in this way, but this is just the law. This is just holding up an impossible idea to show me that I can't get there, and so then I am saved by grace instead. That's the way I would have looked at this before. Naively, thoughtlessly, but that's how I would have looked at it. I look at it very differently now. It seems to me that the psalm is describing the person of God, the person who meditates on his law day and night, the person whose counselors are the apostles and the prophets instead of the image makers and the pundits of our age. Those people are the people that he's describing here. And yet he uses this contrast between the wicked and the righteous. I've talked to you before about it. In other psalms, you can see very clearly that David, when he talks about the wicked and the righteous, he doesn't mean to imply that the righteous are those who are without sin and the wicked are those who are sinners. The clearest example of that, I invite you to look at it, is Psalm 32, where the righteous are described as those who admit that they're sinners. In this psalm, what characterizes the wicked versus the righteous is that ultimate question of who am I going to let be my counselor? The wicked are those who are not interested in the law of God. They listen instead to the world around them. And the righteous are those who are interested in the law of God, who look at it, who learn from it, who are corrected by it, who are reproved by it. People who are in the process of looking at their lives, repenting over what they see there, failing to be what they see in the law of God, lamenting over the fact that they are not what they see in the law of God, calling out to God for mercy, calling out to God for strength, growing in wisdom because they keep going back to what God has said, thinking about it, comparing it to what the world around them is offering, and slowly making that choice, that turn that says, this is the way I want to go. This is the way I want my life to go. Those are the righteous in the terms that he's describing. And the wicked are those who, in one way or another, will not let the truth of God be their counselor, but walk another way. In the terms of this psalm, that's what he means by the wicked and the righteous. So we don't have to be embarrassed to say we want to be numbered among the righteous in the sense that he's describing here. There is no sense in which there is any self-righteousness about that, or there shouldn't be. I'm not saying that I'm any better than any other sinner in this world. I'm not denying the deep, deep problem of evil that my life has had to wrestle with. I am a sinner. I know that that's true. I'm not less of a sinner than anyone else in the world. But I'm called to make this choice. What do I think is true? who am I going to listen to? Those whose hearts respond to the truth and seek after it, those are the ones, I would say, that the Old Testament describes as the righteous. When the righteous and the wicked are sorted out at the end, it's not going to be on the basis of how many sins either group committed. That sort of sorting system doesn't work very well, because you end up with everybody in one group. And it was God's decision not to work it that way. The question is, as a sinner, has my heart become set on the things of God or not? Will I hear? Will I listen? Will I acknowledge the truth and take the next step, whatever that next step might be, in response to that truth? That's the question. That's the thing that sorts out the wicked versus the righteous. Well, very simple psalm here. What it's talking about is not hard to come to terms with, I don't think. But the ideas in it, I think, are very profound. I mean, it's the kind of psalm that takes a fundamental issue and just puts it on the line there. What am I going to take in? What am I going to let influence me? Something is influencing me. And I think we ought to come away from reading a psalm like this recognizing that the world around me has a great influence on me. And I need to wake up and recognize that I'm listening to too many voices that don't know what they're talking about. And at the same time, wake up and recognize I have here the wisdom of people who really knew what they were talking about, because God Himself was at work in making sure that they did know what they were talking about. This is where I ought to go. I mean, there's just no question about it. This is where I ought to go. Well, let's take a little time for some questions or comments. I don't imagine, maybe you have questions about what the passage means. It's pretty simple. Maybe somebody would just like to make some comments about how does something like this strike you in the midst of the actual life that you're living? I mean, what does meditating on the law of God day and night look at like for someone who's working 50 hours a week and raising a family, or someone who's going to school and supporting themselves by having two jobs at the same time? And I mean, what does it look like? Let me ask you the question. Okay, I can see that was a way to cut off conversation quickly. So let's go back to the you can ask the questions if you want.
Ron?
Yes, sir.
A couple of suggestions. You said you were looking for something else to teach on. Were you going to finish your series in here?
That's a possibility. The only reason I have been thinking about not doing that is, like I said, about if I'm going to try to write something else, doing double duty.
And then would you be interested in writing about the parables?
That's on my short list, actually. That's one of the things I have been considering doing. In fact, I almost came today and started a series on the parables. And then I didn't. But yeah, that's one I have been thinking about, definitely.
I'm going to try to go back to your question and shut off all the conversation. I was in the library yesterday doing some research for a paper, and in my field of philosophy and religion, there's a lot of stuff on the shelves. And at one point, I was just going through looking for, I was trying to find something of the Reformed tradition, but they have Calvin's Institutes, and that's it. Right. The rest is just dominated by all kinds of stuff. But in there, I found a very slim volume by a prominent atheistic theologian from India, I think. And my first response was, no, let's stay away from that guy. His ideas are powerful. My second thought was, why? Where's my trust? Who's stronger in any given conflict, ultimately? And Roger and I were having this talk about last week about people's, in the church, this fear of philosophy or this fear of asking questions and thinking about things too much. And my point was that it's not philosophy, it's the idea of faith and sin. So maybe you could respond a little bit on this fearlessness that we can approach things that we may need to, of course, in our calling. It may be somewhat toxic or more difficult to handle, knowing who's behind us, who's backing us up.
I don't know that I have much to add to what you said. I agree with that. That would be, on the one hand, and on the other hand, that would be over on this hand. That to be a person who is interested in the truth, that ought to mean that I can approach a book like that. If this is a person who's making a serious argument, I mean, it's not toxic in the sense that it's going to fill my mind with poisonous images that I can't get out of it, you know, like pornography or something like that. That here's a person who's coming along and saying, I think this is the truth and here's why I think it's the truth. In that kind of situation, yeah, I ought to have the confidence that if the gospel is true, that it can ultimately stand up to a critique like that or an alternative proposal for what reality is really like. It is scary. I mean, just as human beings, I mean, all of us, I think, feel like, you know, the fact is I'm not a prophet. I'm not as confident in my understanding as Paul was in his. So I'm a little bit afraid that something's going to come along and steamroll me. I mean, that I'm just not going to be able to stand up to it. And that, I've felt that fear sometimes. And sometimes it's just sort of a drag. I mean, you read a book like that and about halfway through it, this is really aggravating. My blood pressure goes up when I read that kind of stuff sometimes. But I think you're right. The truth ought to be able to stand up. And it can be helpful to interact with something like that, especially as I'm trying to interact with the ideas of real people around me. I mean, to have seen the best of the arguments against where I'm coming from and to have thought a little bit about what they're saying and to be able to come back and say something to it. To myself, have wrestled with those questions. You know, Bertrand Russell wrote an essay called Why I Am Not a Christian, and some time ago, Jack Crabtree had said that he wanted to write an article called Why I Am Not Bertrand Russell. And I think, in a sense, I think we ought to be prepared to do that. I mean, we ought to be able to look at, here's a really intelligent man who looks at what I believe and says, nah, that doesn't make any sense. I ought to be able to answer him. I mean, not everyone is called upon to make every answer to every question, but we shouldn't be afraid to say, if the Christianity is true, then there's something wrong with his argument, and we ought to go and take a look at it. And likewise, if his argument is absolutely sound, then what's wrong with what I believe? I mean, Christianity can't be true and yet ultimately indefensible. I mean, if it's coherent at all, then it's going to make sense with the rest of the world, and ultimately there will be an answer to the objections that are raised to it. It may not be an answer that people like. It may not be an answer that would convince Bertrand Russell that he was wrong in that argument, but it's, I think you're right. We ought to be unafraid in pursuing those things. I wish I could capture what the difference is. My willingness to read the book you're talking about or something like that, to interact with its ideas, to be prepared to respond to them. There's a difference there between that and what I was describing before, letting fools be my counselors. I don't quite know how to capture it, but I would say that all of us have spent time looking at TV shows that we would have been better off not looking at. I mean, all kinds of ways in which we have let fools be our counselors, where we have let ourselves be influenced and taken in by ideas that we hardly even noticed that we were swallowing. And in that sense, I think we really ought to be careful. But you're right. Fearless, but wise.
And that's to respond to your comment about TV too, because I would want to be clear, just for myself and for others is that I don't feel that same kind of fearlessness with the media. I don't own a TV for the reason that it's much too easy for me to walk into areas and forget how easy it is just to drink that in. When I do watch a TV show, I may flip it on and sit down once a year and see what people are watching, which gives a different perspective. But yeah, that same, that fearlessness, I mean, the fear of being able to be conquered by something, I don't think necessarily would go across the board for all people. Not everybody's going to want to read Bertrand Russell. Not everybody could watch ER every week and come out undisgusted or unscathed.
You know, it's awfully hard to know what to say to some of those things. And I was thinking about this week with the big to-do about the last episode of Seinfeld, which is, I mean, I don't know. It would be interesting to kind of see how the breakdown goes in a group like this. That's a show that I have not watched. I've seen, I do have this terrible habit of turning on the TV and going around the dial looking for something. For a few minutes, you know, like 5 minutes. I'll go around 3 or 4 times, figure out that there's nothing on, say, well, I'll look again. And I'll look again. And I'll look again. And finally figuring out there's nothing on and hopefully turning it off. I have resorted at times to taking our remote control and putting it away in a drawer or something so that I'm just not doing that automatic thing. But I swear, between the mouse on the computer and the remote control on the TV, my hand is going, this finger right here is, you know, going into atrophy or something, I don't know. I didn't watch that show, but I did catch it a couple of times on those, that round that, you know, and it looked like it was really funny. But I couldn't believe what I was seeing sometimes. I mean, you read the articles in the paper about, you know, here's some of the best episodes, you know, hey, here's the masturbation episode, and, you know, here's the oral sex episode over here. And I'm like, my gosh, this is our entertainment. This is what we're sitting around and watching. I mean, that can't help but have an influence on the way I look at the world, I mean, to take in that kind of stuff. So I'm not, you know, I'm on, not on a crusade or anything, but I think all of us would do really well to stop and think about what I'm saying is a lot of the stuff, I'm kind of highlighting entertainment. There are other ways that it can happen, but entertainment is one of the things that has been a trap for me, and it's part of the reason I'm bringing it up, is that entertainment is one of those ways in which we end up with counselors that we don't even recognize that we have taken on as counselors. And that's, I guess that's my word of warning. Okay, Bob, and...
Ron, you asked how those of us who find ourselves with tight schedules and little time can take the advice in this psalm. I am certainly one of those people who has found time to be my enemy and kind of at the mercy of it more often than not. I think recently I've started to see that, I think it's, you know, as Jesus says to, I think it's Mary, I was getting Mary and Martha mixed up in that story, but he says something to the effect that there are only really a couple things that are important. And recently I've had to just kind of simplify my life. And I think the point of the psalm, or one of the points, I think, one of the implications is that there's really only one thing that's important. And so if you get that wrong and you get everything else right, it doesn't matter. So if you're successful and raise a good family and all of those other things, but you aren't a wise person, then made a foolish choice.
Yeah, that's good, Bob. And that's, I mean, that's right. That's not saying to us, so do this and sell this and don't watch this. I mean, those are individual questions that are hard to answer, but those are questions that need to be made within that framework. You're right. There's really only one thing that's important.